apologize for this delay, but I think that's all right. I think now we're in business. Now there's still some noise. I don't understand that. Well, there's another possibility. Let's see if that works using the other input. I guess that's better. Well, we'll have to do it this way. There's two different places to hook. You could hook in several microphones.
Yeah, right.
Using the other one right now, and that looks like it's working all right. And let's see. All right. Why don't we try it? I'll keep monitoring it.
Does this make any difference?
No, it should pick up all the way around.
Well, I know. Well,
but
you know they're.
No, go ahead.
Well, they're just a lot of beams in these walls to the point where an AM reception is very difficult.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Well, I just got to thinking about the pickup here.
Yeah. No, I think we're all right.
Oh, okay.
I can monitor that. This monitors the tape, actually. So, let me put this away somewhere. And let's begin by saying that today is February 7th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Jack Sinclair at this moment, Houston. Mr. Sinclair, I know you were born in Roanoke, Virginia, but I haven't been able to determine exactly when. I think I'm going to say 1919.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
August 17th, 1919.
Okay. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, Roanoke, at the time, and still today, in a way, is a railroad town. Both sides of the family, at the grandparent level, were involved with Norfolk and Western Railroad, Virginia. And the Virginian at that time, and so my father and mother were native to Roanoke, came out of those families. My mother, high school graduate, and my father had some, and I think perhaps almost finished a degree at VPI, now Virginia Tech. And which was interrupted by World War I. He was a lieutenant and took his bride to Wisconsin and was training infantry in Gretishing, Wisconsin. And as far as I know, never saw military action. He didn't go overseas. Afterwards, after the war, he went into public health work with the U.S. Public Health Service, and that lasted until the Depression years, at which time the funding wasn't available in Virginia, but at about that time there were major floods on the Mississippi River and very severe public health problems, typhoid fever, dysentery, things of this sort. So he went to northern Louisiana, southern Arkansas, and worked as a public health officer for, again, the U.S. Public Health Service. For about 7 or 8 months, came back to Virginia, picked up the family, including me, and we moved to Shreveport, Louisiana. Now, I don't know whether that's or something that you want to know about the...
How old were you when you moved to Shreveport?
I was 11 plus, almost.
Okay. So you had had some early schooling already.
I had schooling in
Well, when you got to Shreveport, over
Well, it was the Depression time.
It was Depression, a very, very, very tough time.
What was schooling like in Shreveport?
Well, schooling was fine. I had about a, as I recall, about a month and a half wait from the time we got there until I was able to enroll as a freshman in high school. Went to Seton Bird High School, totally segregated, of course, at that time, all white. Actually finished my work in about 3 years, but laid off 9 months before I took a scholarship at Tulane. At the time, I had offers for scholarships at Cornell. Didn't have the money to get there, which eliminated that. I wanted to go very badly, but I knew by then I wanted to be an engineer. Also, of course, at LSU and one or two other smaller places, but Tulane had a state scholarship that paid all the tuition and all the books for all 4 years of my undergraduate work, and that seemed like a very good deal.
Was that a competitive scholarship?
That was a competitive scholarship.
How did you develop this interest in engineering?
Well, particularly in the course of the high school education, of course, Shreveport was a, in a way, a center for the oil and gas industry at that time. In fact, there were a couple of little refineries, what are now, of course, that would be looked at as little refineries, different people. But there were oil fields around in northern Louisiana, East Texas, of course, had already blossomed in terms of oil production, etc. And in the course of that, and in fact, as an example, in being interviewed for the Cornell scholarship, this was an independent oil and gas producer who was a Cornell alumnus. We visited some of his facilities. In fact, had a couple of really hairy experiences. Particularly one day, but in any event,
you want to describe one of those?
We went up to Rodessa, which is right close to Texarkana on the Louisiana-Texas border, and it was a gas plant, natural gas plant, and this well sat basically next to a highway, but was ready to be brought in, if you will, ready to be put on production. To make the long story short, the mud did not contain the gas. The gas got loose, not in an explosive way, but certainly plenty of it. And everybody running like mad, drove down the highway, evacuated a bunch of people. And that scared the dickens out of me, particularly since Mr. Wheelis, which was his name, in running, broke his leg, trying to jump over a pipe rack that was about this high, I guess. And I wound up driving his car back to Shreveport with him as a passenger. But in any event, back to the subject. Through all of that, I knew I was good and was doing very well in my studies, particularly science and math. So I developed an attraction for the engineering profession, more or less through exposure of that sort.
You also have mentioned that one of the people who had an influence in your life was Grover Kaufman, who was your high school principal.
Yeah, he was a high school principal.
In what way did he?
Well, he's the guy that rounded up these scholarships as an example of the opportunities for him, and was very, very influential in my decision to let you. I can remember him saying, you know, you don't want to mess around with this. You don't want to go to LSU if you've got a chance to. Education much better you've got a real good deal here in terms of tuition, et cetera. So, it, very major influence in that respect, no question.
Okay. What was it like when you got to Tulane and I'm going to say 36?
36. Mm-hmm. Well, it was difficult. There was a major social adjustment problem for me. It's not so much that way nowadays, although all the vestiges of it are not totally eliminated. But Tulane is oriented to New Orleans, and particularly to uptown New Orleans. And its fraternities and Newcomb colleges, girls, associations, etc., are oriented that way. The structure is that way in terms of not only the social aspect, but also the money for supporting the university. And it was particularly so at that time. You know, tied into carnival crews and who's going to be this and the influence in the community, etc. And it was, and in that respect, was fairly tightly knit to the point that someone from North Louisiana, regardless of any Virginia background, anyone from North Louisiana was redneck automatically. And I had real difficulty with that for the first, I'd say the first year. And I did not join a fraternity. I was invited to one, the only one, but I didn't. It just didn't seem to be the right kind of thing. And so I spent my time basically doing my college work. And then by the time we got to the summer vacations each year, I was fortunate enough to get a job for each summer, each of the three summers, that basically paid for the rest of my expenses for the year. And what I did was I was, again, lucky enough through my mother to have a ladies group in the Episcopal Church in Freeport loan me money at the back end of a particular year. The first part then of my summer work would go to pay that loan and to get me through, say, the first few months of the next year, and then pay them back again. And that happened until I graduated and came to work for Shell, and one of the first things I had to do was pay off the last loan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of stories about Tulane, but...
What was the department like, the chemical engineering department?
It was good. It was good. And in retrospect, it was even better than I realized at the time. A man named Williamson, who was one of the founders of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, one of the originals, was a professor. And he retired during the course of my stay there, and a man named Francis Taylor became the professor. Taylor was there in the field as well. Williamson had a major influence on my thinking and my career, and Taylor even more so. We formed, while I was there, and in fact I was the first chairman or president, whatever the title was, the student chapter of the American Institute of Engineers. First time we've done that. So these people were at the heart of it. I look back on the facilities, and if anything, they were only barely adequate. Although I'm sure the program was properly sanctioned, secondary school type of associated, etc., but the equipment, etc., would by today's standards would just quit.
Petroleum engineering, was that a separate function?
There was no petroleum engineering, of course, as such, at Tulane. And petroleum engineering, as I understand it, and as practiced particularly still today at places like Texas A&M, is more oriented to the exploration and production side of the business than the chemical engineering. Although both have many, many common things in common.
So
we're coming through all right here.
As far as I can tell, okay. I have a needle here I'm watching too.
Oh, all right. Okay.
There's still some noise, but I think we're all right. I don't know what the source of that noise is. You got out of Tulane in 1940.
Yes, sir.
Well, you had a loan to pay back.
I had a loan to pay back. I had a brother who had laid out of school for a year between high school and before he went to college, my younger brother, and so I had him to put through school. These were tough times. My father and mother were working to some degree, but they certainly couldn't cover all the bases by any means. And so it was pretty much a self-generated situation. I'll tell you a story about how I happened to get a job, because it was still at Tulane. In the senior year, in a unit operations lab, and the schedule was a couple of mornings a week, and it was basically each all morning, and of course it was dirty work, and so we were dressed in khakis or something of the sort. And this particular morning, Dr. Williamson came in and said, there's some people from up at the Narco refinery with Shell here, and if any of you guys would like an interview, they'll listen to you. So I borrowed a necktie and went to see him. And I had a man named Hurley and Gage. And had great difficulty with Mr. Gage. He had a wall eye, like that. And I had trouble focusing my attention in that regard. But they seemed most impressed, not necessarily with the grades or anything of this sort, but with my experience during the summer, during which time I had been running a WPA crew with about 50 men in it. And I was the foreman, if you will, building outhouses in the country in southern Louisiana. And they seemed to be impressed with that. And so a few weeks after that, I got an offer by telegram to report to the Wood River Refinery in Illinois. A month later, I had to look up all the maps and all this. A month after that, another telegram saying, we changed our mind and report to Houston. That was much easier for me. So that's how we started. I did not have enough money because of these other obligations to get here any other way except hitchhiking. So I hitchhiked over here and found a room at the YMCA and went from there.
What was your...
Is that interesting stuff?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I don't want to bore...
No.
You.
No, that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm looking for. What was it, an exciting time for you when you were... What was your feeling when you were hitchhiking to Houston?
Oh, I was just on cloud nine. I was just... really so happy to get the job. Only three people out of the whole class of engineers, not just chemicals, had a job at all at graduation day. One of them went to Texaco, at Port Arthur, one went to what's now Exxon at Baytown, I went to Shell, and that was it. But we came at different times and under different circumstances, so there was no commonality there. But I was excited. I was looking forward to the challenge. I've heard a lot of things about what happens to people in the first few weeks that they're in an oil refinery and this sort of thing. So I was really charged, no question.
What was your first assignment?
First assignment was in what was called the gas department as a technical trainee at $115 a month. And the job involved technical work in and around the first sulfuric acid alkylation plant. Come on, remember this was 1940 and before World War II, and of course alkylation turned to be one of the major contributors to the war effort. So I had fun with that.
When the war started, then, did that have any real effect? And was there a chance of you ever being drafted?
Oh, yeah. I was 1A over and over again throughout the entire war. Every 6 months of deferment, get the 1A classification, and nothing deferment. Somebody was looking at me. I didn't understand just exactly that process. But in the early stages of it, I had a Navy commission and bought the uniforms and was within 3 days of shipping out and got called back. And it just simply had to do with kind of what I was doing. Somebody, for a change in the government, I say a change, they're not always alive to this, decided I was going to be worth more there than on a battleship somewhere. Meantime, towards the end of the war, my brother, younger brother, who was finishing up at Tulane by this time, got his naval commission. He was naval ROTC, and then he went to the Pacific. So we were representing.
When you first started here in Houston, did you find the people that you were working with helpful? Were they
very much so, very supportive, and very quickly, of course, we were in a position where we were working 6 days a week, and if you didn't have your colleagues on some common ground with you and being supportive, you had real problems. I did not. They were wonderful. We did a lot of very, very good things. Shell's refinery at Deer Park here turned out to be the number one largest aviation gasoline blender and shipper. Didn't manufacture every component, but in the entire nation. I don't remember the numbers, but they were big. I participated in the startup as a technologist in the startup of the first ever toluene extraction plant, phenol extraction, which was a Shell process. First one ever built anywhere. And of course, that toluene was all part of the war effort too. So we had a lot of things going. No question.
What does this term technologist mean?
It means it's engineering. It's a title still used in Shell.
Okay.
It's less than an assistant manager, but it is. It is pretty much what it sounds like. It's technical work. Mine was widely different types. I got moved around all through the complex, different jobs at different times, but it was always in that category. The last year or so of the war, I was an assistant manager, and there I worked in the control lab, and that meant dealing with the Army and Navy inspectors and running a control situation on the manufactured quality aspects, the blending aspects of aviation gasoline, so, and shipping. One of the most difficult times, difficult parts of that was that, of course, most of the men were off the door. So at one time, I had 95 women and 6 men doing this. And that presented some fairly significant problems from time to time. The ladies were not always good behaviors.
I assume also that most of these people's background or training was limited, so therefore you really...
They were, at best, high school, and a number of them were certainly during those wars, And that, excuse me, that applied not just in that laboratory, but throughout the complex. There were women operators, or even assistant mechanics of one sort or another, fitters, pipe fitters, bottom makers, machinists.
I can see now why they were interested in your WPA supervision experience.
Well, it was great. It was a great experience. I certainly learned some lessons. No question about that.
But it sounds like you were given a lot of responsibility very quickly.
I was, and I'm very lucky to have that. Very pleased to. It presented some real challenges from time to time, but you know, I'm thinking back on it, Jim. It just never seemed to pile up on me to a point of feeling that, my goodness, I wish this was over, or I'm overloaded. It just didn't happen. I was interested, critically interested, in what was going on, and I had enough of a role of responsibility to feel that from time to time I was really doing some good. And I think that's kind of the key. I also had, outside of work itself, I also had no family to deal with. So there was no obligation there except to write my mother once in a while. But I had some church life, and that helped a great deal. And so, I'd say pretty balanced for that. Immediately after VJ Day, I got shipped to New York, and things changed.